Welcome to Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble, and we're here today to talk about the Anglo-Asante Wars that took place all throughout the 19th century in Western Africa off the Gold Coast. If you're not familiar with the show, every week I research and discuss a historical topic. The next week, I'll branch off from the previous week's topic, making our way around the world across space and time. And since it's the first episode of the new year, I thought I'd answer something, like why? Why am I doing this? Why discuss history? What's the point of this show? So studying history is, if you're one of these people that are like, I don't get why we bother studying history, it's not just an exercise in like memorizing dates and events. It's like you're exploring human experience. You're really understanding people and understanding where we're at and where we're going. And so by examining all of these different triumphs and failures and things that have happened in the past, you just gain a deeper understanding of the complex forces that are at work in our world today. If you understand what they were 10 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, you'll have a better understanding of how those forces apply today. Because I think people get this idea that history happens in a vacuum and everything we're doing now does not relate to it, but it's all so interconnected. So it also kind of helps you foster some cultural empathy when you understand where people came from, and you just become a more informed person, you know, and you start to recognize patterns in the world, you know, and we're just learning from our mistakes. It just makes us more empathetic people, more informed, educated people, and also it's fun. I think some of the best stories in history are true stories. And that's why I'm here. And so, okay, so then why should you listen to me? That's the other question. And I'll be honest, that's a hard question for me to answer. You know, I have a professional background in IT. Okay, so what? I wasn't a great student in school. I'm really, really impressing you here. I didn't even give history much of a time of day when I was in school. Not at all. But here's the best answer I can get. And this is the truth. I'm an average person in terms of my knowledge of history. Sure, I've learned a lot in the past 6 months on and off reading books and things for the past, you know, 20 years, 30, you know, really 20 years. But I'm hoping that I'm not looking to lecture anybody here. You know, I'm just doing research, seeing what I can find, and sharing that with people and giving my, you know, I'm not trying to say, I try not to have too hard of a perspective. I'm always trying to look at the other side of things. And I'm hoping eventually I get a diversity of perspectives from people. Like, I really love feedback. I know this show's really not off the ground hardly yet, but if you have anything you want to give feedback on for this show, I really encourage you. The email address is feedback@meridianspodcast.com. It's also in the show notes. But anything you want to give feedback on, and you know, I will always, if you don't want anything read on the show, I'm not going to, but if you're okay with it, I will probably, it's a very good chance I'm going to want to discuss it on the show because I love a perspective of corrections too. I'm not going to get everything right. Nobody does. But then personally, why I want to do the show is because I crave a creative outlet. I always have. I've gone through all kinds of different hobbies. I've made video games and I've done all kinds of art. I've got a really deep background in art, but I've made software. I've done all kinds of goofy things on my own. I made a comic book one time. I've just done a lot of different things, and I just have found that this is kind of a great consensus of all these things. I get to do all kinds of interesting things. But this also kind of gives me a sense of purpose, you know, in life. It's something to work on, something to think about. I have a very restless mind, and it really helps me keep going and have a good positive outlook. And so with that being said, I'm happy you're here. And let's get on with the show.
Welcome to Meridians.
Okay, a quick recap if you didn't listen to the last episode, or maybe it's just been a while. The Asante Empire was an empire that was inland from the Gold Coast of Africa. In the grand scheme of things in Africa, it wasn't the biggest empire. If you look at maps of how big the Asante Empire was at like the mid-19th century, it wasn't the biggest empire. But for the specific area they were in and the surrounding tribes, they were in kind of a key position that the British were going to have to deal with them, and the Dutch, of course, too. So this empire consisted of an area in Ghana and neighboring states, and it came to be after Osei Tutu and his friend and high priest Okomfo Onokye claimed that a golden stool had come down from the heavens to unite the Akan people, which was the ethnic group these folks belonged to. The Asante grew in power by defeating the previously powerful empire in the region, the Denkyiren Empire. The Denkyira Empire. I keep saying Denkyiren, but that's not right. Like the Denkyiren people, but I think you say Denkyiras, actually. So it's the Denkyira Empire. But from there, this Asante Empire grew throughout the 18th century and into the 19th century, getting relatively rich on gold. There was a lot of gold mines in their area, and they were getting rich from that and also trading slaves to Europeans, which the Europeans were, they weren't just on the coast for gold, and they weren't just on the coast for slaves. It was whatever they could make money on, whatever they're going to get rich on. You know, it could be food, it could be wood, it could be anything, whatever they can get that's worth trading profitably. So that's what happened in the previous episode. So now here's where we're going to leave it off. It's right around basically where we left off would have been towards the end of the, well, actually it was really more like the beginning of the 19th century. And the Asante keep gaining territory, but they start butting heads with their neighbors. Well, saying they started butting heads isn't quite right. Things heated up. They were constantly having skirmishes, you know, border disputes. You know, it's not like they had perfectly defined maps back then. So they're going to get into little skirmishes, but things really started to heat up with the neighboring confederacy, the Fante Confederacy. And you could say this all started with two rebels who had escaped from the Asante Empire into the Fante British-controlled territory. And that's not to say that if these rebels hadn't escaped, none of the following events would have happened. I think that type of thinking where it's like, well, this happened, and then all of these other things happened, like a whole bunch of dominoes fell. That's not really the case. That's kind of like just saying that World War I wouldn't have happened if Franz Ferdinand had not been shot. Something was going to happen. There's a more kind of a momentum to things, I think. And changing one little variable isn't going to cancel out all the other forces that were at play. So sure, things may have played out a little differently to degrees, but the basic events probably would still have happened. The same is the case here. So leading into these Anglo-Asante wars, there's wars amongst some tribes. So the Fante Confederation, they were a group of tribes, not unlike how the Asante Empire had formed. Osei Tutu had gathered a bunch of smaller tribes to unite against the Denkyira Empire. But then this Denkyira Empire ended up actually joining up with the Fante Confederacy. So it was they had been severely weakened, and so they had to start their own confederacy or join in with the Fante Confederacy. And the Fante Confederacy sided with the British. So you've got the Central Asante Empire, and then to the south of them is this Fante Confederacy. Well, loosely, it's not exactly to the south, but they're kind of a buffer between the Fante are a buffer between the Asante Empire and the British on the coast. And the Asante mostly traded, they were actually trading with the Dutch at the time. So you've got the Dutch who are favoring the Asante, the British who are favoring the Fante Confederacy. So envoys are sent from the Asante Kingdom to the Fante region to get these two rebels back, these two prisoners. And the Fante respond by killing the envoys. So this completely, obviously, provokes the Asante. Now, it's unclear if Gerard Butler was there and kicked these envoys down a well, but that's all I can see right now in my head. So just like that, the Asante declared war on the Fante, and it really seems to me like someone or another was just looking for some pretext to start a conflict. Now, remember, the Europeans' interest in all this was that the British are allied with the Fante, and, you know, there's that buffer there between them and the Asante. And the Dutch, of course, were allied with the Asante. And both the Asante and the Dutch wanted to limit British influence in the area. So the Dutch were going to do what they could to help the Asante here. And it's sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend sort of a deal. I wondered if it was kind of a proxy war between the British and the Dutch, but it's not really the case. They were acting, not primarily anyway, the Asante and the Fante are really acting in their own interest, and they stand to gain directly from a positive outcome in this war. So it wasn't some kind of proxy war, you know, like you might expect, like did happen quite often, but not in this. It doesn't seem to be really the case here. So this Asante-Fante war started in 1806 and lasted about a year. Asante then sacked Abura, which is one of the Fante cities, in May of that year. And then later they attacked a British fort in Enomabu, where the fugitives were being held. These two fugitives. They're still after these two fugitives. So 800 Fante are killed in this battle, which is, you know, it's pretty brutal just to get a couple fugitives back. So after this, the Fante basically lost. The remaining Fante leaders then were forced to swear allegiance to the Asantehene Ose Bansu and the local British governor, George Turenne, and they make peace with the local governor, George Turenne, makes peace with the Asante, which was probably a smart move at the time because the Asante kind of had a upper hand. They had just showed that they could defeat their neighboring force. And the Asantehene, that's basically the leader, by the way, Ose Bansu, was the current leader of the Asante, and they called him the Asantehene. And so these wars are just getting started, though. A few years later, in 1811, there was a conflict called the Ga Fante Wars, which involved the Asante and their allies, the Ga people, against the Fante again. And so much for that swearing of allegiance to the Asantehene on part of the Fante. That just kind of fell away, it seems like. So this war actually hurts the Asante, even though they do take control of one British fort at Tantamquery. Good Lord. Okay, so they weren't going to stop there, though. Another war just heated up a few years later. So, you know, you had this war in 1806, then another war in 1811, and then another war in 1814. So they just constantly are kind of battling with their neighbors. So this war in 1814 is called the Asante-Akim-Akwapim War. But the conflict is also referred to as the Asante Invasion of the Gold Coast. So you can imagine how that war went and what it was about. There's actually not a ton of information about this war either. So I'm kind of glossy. I mean, I kind of have to gloss over here. I just want to be clear that now the Asante have kind of gotten their way and they've grown in strength. But despite the challenge brought on by other tribes and the British, you know, so this was about 1816, 1817 now. So it took a few years for all this to happen. But the Asante do invade the Gold Coast. And it's not like they stay there, though. They're kind of pushed. They're not just controlling the coast. The British are still there, and they've still got to. It's just that, think of it this way, that every year it seems like these Asante are pushing and pushing harder towards the British on the coast. And it's pretty obviously something is going to come to a head here. This pressure keeps building. So finally, you know, this is where we're going to get into war between the Anglo and the Asante. So the British and the Asante go to war. So it's time to start talking about that. So let's introduce Sir Charles McCarthy. Oh, this poor guy. In 1814, Charles McCarthy was appointed the governor of Sierra Leone. And he had previously been the governor of Senegal, but that after the Napoleonic Wars, the territory was returned to France, so McCarthy was kind of without a place to govern. But fortunately for him, there was this newly created colony of Sierra Leone. And it was a colony created to resettle black loyalists from the Revolutionary War in the United States. Yes, there were black loyalists who fought for the British, and this colony was the reward they were given. Their ancestors were likely plucked from this very same coastline, probably a century or two before, made slaves, and then now a few generations later, here they were coming back full circle. It's kind of weird. But I kind of wonder if that's ever been a thing in history where you take a big chunk of people, move their entire culture over across an ocean, and then 100 years later, you kind of send them back, or some of them, you know. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of sad and messed up to be doing this. But anyway, so McCarthy's this governor of Sierra Leone. So from here, McCarthy, he seems like a pretty decent guy, even though he has some missteps later. He really did help to build this colony up for these liberated slaves from the former colonies. He also started to help out the locals in general, just anyone that was in the region. He actually seemed like a decent guy. He tried to shut down the slave trade entirely, which was, it was actually technically abolished by the British Empire in 1807, but the momentum of it, and, you know, nobody's actually, it's not like there's some group from England down there saying, you know, watching everything they do, making sure they aren't actually sending slaves over to the Americas or shipping slaves from there. They kind of just kept doing what they were doing for a while. But in 1821, the British finally, so, you know, 1807 to 1821, they were still just operating business as usual, pretty much. But the British finally shut down the African Company of Merchants because they were still in the slave trade. They were supposed to stop, but they just couldn't seem to stop themselves, or it's kind of silly. But this was actually the company that replaced the Royal African Company, which is, I sort of covered them 2 episodes ago when we first got to Africa. And that, there you go. That is their end right there. The end of the Royal African Company, the end of the African Company of Merchants. So this is kind of the end of the, sort of the end of the slave trade, at least for the British in the region. I'm sure it kept going on for a while. It's kind of hard to say when you're trying to keep things a secret. But from here, the end of the Asante conflicts with the Fante, there's still tension and disputes over land ownership. So the Asante claimed the entire coastline the British were occupying as their territory and were demanding rent, which, of course, the British refused to pay because they're the British Empire and they don't really care. They're, you know, that's, if they accept that, then they, you know, have to accept all these other things. It's all politics, you know. So over time, this led to further conflicts between the Fante and the Asante. And here we go again. This time, however, the Fante had an ally in Governor George McCarthy, and he wasn't about to take shit from the Asante, or so he thought. You know, he thought he was going to come in and be this real tough governor, and he's like, I'm not putting up with this Asante. We're starting this colony, and we have to put our foot down right away. You can't cow down. So tensions rose, and McCarthy declared war on the Asante in January of 1824. And when I say tensions rose, I'm having to gloss over some details for time's sake. There's a whole lot of things that happened. There was a beheading of a merchant. Words were exchanged. Things just got kind of messy, and it's complicated. But the result was that about 1,000 British forces, soldiers, and maybe 10,000 or so local conscripted forces, along with a whole heap of hubris on the part of General McCarthy, he goes on the warpath. His plan is one of shock and awe. He thought that he would just push in hard with an overwhelming force and take out the Asante force, just kind of smash them without, you know, without any good planning, organization, or anything that a normal army general does. You know, but his plan was enough of this. Let's go. And McCarthy thinks these are a bunch of disparate bands. So he arrives at a river. Sorry, I was jumping ahead. He arrives at a river with this force, and he sees a large force gathering on the other side. He's like, all right. McCarthy thinks these are a bunch of disparate bands of Fante soldiers who'd come to help in his efforts. They're like, all right, more people to help. It was actually 10,000 Asante warriors. And, you know, they start to realize that, okay, they're not on the same side. And I'd love to see how this battle starts. But apparently they started shooting at each other across the river. And this battle primarily seems to have taken place across the river, shooting across the river at one another, like some kind of OK Corral type deal. But the Asante were apparently heavily armed and ready for battle. They were ready for this, in other words. And McCarthy's side apparently was not. It seems like he was quite hasty. That's why I said a whole heaping of hubris was involved in this, because it seemed like he just really, it was quite the blunder. I mean, what was he thinking? Like, why would you, it was really just kind of a huge failure on his part. So things start to get ugly for his side, and he tries to flee. But then he is shot and killed during his escaped attempt. And this is how the first Anglo-Asante War begins. This is kind of the first shot or the first battle. McCarthy's killed. Not a good way for the British to start. The Asante actually turned McCarthy's skull into a gilded drinking cup, which was then used by the Asante leadership in years to come. So that's nice. They got themselves a little token to remember the battle by. Yikes. So the Asante start to push to the coast now, having been victorious. They actually had won there was actually another battle that happened like a week later at the same location. It kind of just seems to be where they're kind of the edge of their border, maybe, or maybe it's just a natural place for that many people to be able to even gather and attack each other. And the British still, the battle ended in a stalemate again. It's kind of a stalemate before. It's not like the Asante pushed and kept forcing their way into battle, pushing the British all the way back to the coast at first. So both of these battles end in a stalemate, but the British still retreat to the coast. So the Asante are still kind of winning. They were forced to lay off, though, in just kind of, it's kind of, this is how all these wars go. There's like, okay, this happened, and then they stop fighting. But the Asante had to lay off because disease had kind of swept through their forces, and they knew they couldn't just keep driving to the coast, or they'd all die and they'd just get decimated. They weren't healthy. They weren't a healthy force. And so they had to lay back and cool off for a while. And during this time, this kind of gave the British a chance to recoup and regroup. The new governor of the Gold Coast, John Hope Smith, rallies a force of 10,000 along the coast awaiting for an Asante attack. They find out that the Asante might be planning an attack on Accra. And he gathers this force of 10,000 soldiers, and they await in an open field a ways north of the city. The Asante force then arrive, and they came in hard, attacking right at the center of the British force. And the British were actually managing their flanks well, but the Asante kind of looked to be in trouble. They smashed the center. They were doing all right in the center, but they were, kind of starting to get routed, surrounded on the flanks. And then things get really bad because the British showed up with a new weapon that the Asante had never seen before. They had rockets with them. Yeah, they brought rockets to a musket fight. Yet primarily they were still going to be fighting with swords and muskets and just bows and arrows still too. But they were well armed. The Asante were well armed, and they knew how to use rifles. They'd been using them for centuries, really. And they were experienced with fighting with muskets. So both sides are fighting with muskets and rifles and swords. It's very, kind of think of like Civil War type battles, But now they got rockets to contend with, and these rockets were called Congreve rockets. I highly recommend you look up what these rockets looked like. They sort of looked like they just were like fireworks. The drawing I saw was just so pathetic. It just looks like a post with like a stick of dynamite on it. It just looks silly. It just looks so cartoonishly silly. But they were developed by William Congreve in 1808 after they had been used against the East India Company, so used against the British, by the Kingdom of Mysore in southern India. And Congreve studied these rockets and then designed his own version of them. So these rockets were used in the battle, and it just scared the shit out of the Asante. It was just quite a novelty and a spectacle. And, you know, these rockets would land on the ground and explode, and what the hell? It's not a cannon. It's not, you know, it's just kind of wild. So they, you know, making different noises they'd never heard before, doing different kind of damage that they'd never seen before. And as a result, the Asante just withdrew from the conflict. And this is kind of the end of the first Anglo-Asante War. This right here kind of ends it. You know, so this, they didn't really come out very well, the Asante, but their borders actually kind of got pushed back a little bit. So it actually took them a while, but so this war started in like 1824, and they didn't actually draw up borders and sort of end the war officially until 1831, and that the border was drawn up along the Pra River. So now there's this relative peace between the British and the Asante for like 30 years. The start of the second Asante War would be kind of familiar, though. The Asante crossed the river, this border that had just been drawn up, in pursuit of a fugitive. Oh boy, here we go. Nobody's going to overreact here. So it feels a bit dramatic to call this war a second war, though, because it seems like it was fairly uneventful. So it was kind of a large force that of Asante that had crossed the Pra River in pursuit of these fugitives. What were they thinking? You know, they were going to just provoke a war, but it was kind of a large group, and it provoked the British into battle. So this happened in 1863. It really, there was no giant decisive battles here, it doesn't sound like. There was just a bunch of small skirmishes that ended in a stalemate the following year. The war seemed to have really been shut down once again, sort of because disease had hit the area and both sides were forced to just kind of retreat. Okay, what were we even fighting about? Let's just go back to what we were doing. It was just quite uneventful and inconclusive. So then in 1867, the British Gold Coast was officially established as a colony. And now you start changing things and start drawing up borders and saying, well, yeah, we're buying this, and you know, things are going to get ugly. So it's not just trading and slaving. The slaving's kind of over, and now it's time to bring in some Jesus, you know? Sure. We just spent the past 250 years just totally taking advantage of the entire region, and now we're going to tell you about morality. God damn it. Ugh, the freaking gall. So in 1869, a German missionary family and a Swiss missionary family, a Swiss missionary had been kidnapped. Apparently, somebody in the Asante Empire didn't like what they were saying, so they kidnapped them and took them to Togo, from Togo to Kumasi, which was the capital of the Asante Empire. And by 1873, they were still being held captive. And these were evangelicals on the British Gold Coast who were there to bring their religious views and to educate the locals. The Asante took them and demanded ransom for their return. So they were after money, I guess. I don't know if they were trying to provoke the British. It didn't really say, like, were they trying to provoke them into war? It's very unclear. But this would definitely do it. So in 1872, Britain expanded their territory when it purchased the Dutch Gold Coast from the Dutch. And this included El Mina, which the Asante, of course, had claimed. In other words, so the Asante had all along been saying, well, the Dutch. You're on our land anyway. This is our land. And then the Dutch sells this land that they don't own in the eyes of Isante to the British. So they didn't have a right to sell it in the first place because it was the Isantes. And that's the Isante point of view. So then the Isante decided to assert themselves and invade the area, which is now part of a British protectorate officially. And this is different than before. They aren't just dipping into the Fante Empire. This is part of British territory. It's a whole different animal now. There's been 30 years, and the British Empire is not the same. It's much, much, much more powerful than it was before. So General Garnet Wolseley responds to the Isante threat by slowly and steadily building a road towards the Isante capital of Kumasi. And this doesn't sound like a very, you know, very provocative response, but it's not. It's a very cold and calculated response. This isn't that he's not the same as General McCarthy. This guy is much brighter. He's clearly more well supplied as well because they understand what they're up against now. So the road would allow the British to have a good supply line and path for British troops to travel on. They had 2,500 well-armed British troops. They were using prefabricated structures for bridges. They had fortifications established roughly every 70 kilometers. So there'd basically be this fort that they could hide out in. Every 70 kilometers, it was basically a supply chain they're creating, right? And they had medical huts. They had a telegraph office for communication. They also had 400 tons of food and ammunition for supplies. They were well prepared. The British were even starting to use the drug quinine every day, which prevented malaria. And remember why they were there, really. Let's be honest why they're there. What's the British point? Why go to all this trouble? It's not because of some border dispute. This is about gold. It's not about being provoked. They were going to move in on the Isante one way or another sometime or another and try to assimilate them into the British Empire. This wasn't about spreading Christianity. It was about or bringing locals out of poverty or educating them. Primarily, in the eyes of the leadership of the British Empire, this would have been about gold. So the British, in January 29th of 1874, the road to Kumasi is over half completed. The British forces arrived at the Isante outposts. They finally had made it to where the Isante had their own outposts. So then General Wolseley prepared for battle. I mean, I'm sure they knew this was coming. They knew those outposts were there, and they were at the point where, okay, we can't keep building. We're going to run into conflicts against the Isante. So then the Battle of Mofal begins a few days later on January 31st. So this is at a town, a specific town where this battle takes place, where there's this outpost. The British had horns blaring, blasting music, and they made their way in as an organized army, and they basically drove back the Isante forces. It was a fairly bloodless battle on the side of the British. Within a few days, the Isante fled. The British forces, like I said, they had minimal casualties, and they continued this march toward Kumasi. So it was very successful on the British side, completely demoralizing for the Isante. They simply could not get anywhere with this British force. They were just much more organized, and they were just outmatched by the British. And the British continue this march towards Kumasi, the Isante capital, and the city had basically been abandoned by the Isante, having known that the British were arriving. So they just, you know, they couldn't beat them in battle, so they had to abandon their city. I guess it was kind of a practical thing. I was a bit surprised that the British were able to just arrive and take the city so easily. But they used explosives then, and they destroyed the royal palace. The city was left in ruins. I guess the British were really impressed by what they saw. And this is where a lot of plunder would happen. And a lot of these a lot of the relics that were taken end up in the United States of all places, but I'll mention that later. It's kind of interesting. But so my question here, though, is with so much of the success the Asante had in the past, I was just surprised that why didn't they put up more of a fight here? But those previous conflicts, remember, they were one war after another. I mean, I'd kind of started this in 1808, but the Asante had been at war for, gosh, hundreds of years at that point, and their generations of warriors were constantly fighting. But they had this 30 years of relative peace, and the British, they didn't have the seasoned, experienced soldiers that the British had. They were just outmatched. The British at this point were an incredibly powerful empire. They had made immense technological advances in the past several decades, and they had fought battles all over the world at this point. They knew how to fight in almost any condition. Like I said, you can see they knew what they were doing when they built these roads. They were well supplied and just well organized, and the Asante just were not prepared for fighting an enemy like that. So then the Asante are forced to sign the Treaty of Fomena in July of 1874 to put an end to the war. They just, you know, we need to stop fighting. So they're also forced to pay the sum of, or they're ordered to pay the sum of 50,000 ounces of approved gold as payback for the cost of the war. Yeah, so we invaded you, we sacked your city, and for our trouble, we want you to pay us gold. That sounds very much like the British Empire. They were also forced to accept free trade and to keep that road to Kumasi open all the way to the Prah River. So, yeah, obviously they want that road. What do you think they're going to put on that road? Gold. So several artifacts that were actually taken during that raid, this is what I was mentioning earlier, they ended up in museums in the United States, and they were actually just returned to the Asante in February of 2024. So it's kind of a fun reminder that we're just not that far removed from this stuff, from this history. You know, these things are still very active and things are always changing. And I don't know, just thought that was kind of interesting that they returned that. So these missionaries, by the way, the missionaries, I forgot to bring up the missionaries. The missionaries who had been held in Kumasi, they were still there and they were freed. And the German missionary, he vowed to bring Christianity to Kumasi. And so I'm like, oh, okay, I wonder if he succeeded in that. And I looked up Ghana today. Ghana is 70% Christian today. I was a little surprised. I don't know why I was surprised to see that, but I guess he was successful, I suppose. Now, a reasonable person would think that this is where the wars end. You know, but we've still got two more wars to go. So what do you think? Let's do a little trivia here. What do you think the pretext of the Fourth Anglo-Asante War was? Was it A, another escaped convict? B, the Asante failed to pay the fines levied by the British? Or C, the British stole the golden stool of the Asante? The answer is B. The Asante didn't pay back that gold amount. In reality, the amount of 50,000 ounces of gold was all but forgotten by the British. They wanted to annex the Asante nation once and for all. So in 1895, the Asante, they had refused to give up their sovereignty. And, you know, the British said, hey, look, we're just going to come in and take your country, basically, and said, you should become a part of our colony. It's better with us. You should join. And they said, no, we want to keep our sovereignty. And so the Asante sent a delegation to London to negotiate peace in exchange for gold. So now they're like, we'll give you some gold. But the British had already made up their mind. They wanted the Asante territory, and they were going to take it. The British marched again to Kumasi and demanded that the leaders pay back the 50,000 ounces of gold they'd promised. And probably before they even got a chance to respond, they said, oh, you're not going to pay back? Okay. Well, the British declared they were going to take the Asante Empire into their protection, in air quotes, and the Asante leaders were then forced into exile. At least most of them were forced into exile in the Seychelles. So the British literally just marched in, and there was very little resistance in this invasion. It was basically a conquest. Surely the British just made the calculations and realized, hey, you know, we could probably just take Kumasi now. And no one could do anything about it. And you're like, yeah, we probably could. Let's do that. And that's the Fourth Anglo-Asante War, if you could even call it a war. I don't even know why they're... I mean, I guess you put enough time between a war, I'm sure there's some calculation or reason why historians will call something a war, an individual war or not. Who cares? The fifth and final war... This war is the dumbest of all. The fifth war. It was really stupid. And I mean on behalf of the British. One specific British person anyway. This is the year 1900 now. So now we're at 1900. You know, the first war started in 1808. Or no, rather, the first war started in 1823. The first conflict with Afante had started in 1808. But now it's 1900. And so just a few years after the Asante Empire had came under British protection. And Sir Frederick Mitchell Hodgson was in Kumasi, and he's in charge. And he's the British guy in charge of the region. And he had heard about the Golden Stool. And he misunderstood its importance. He didn't realize, he thought, oh, well, it's the leader's chair. So he insisted he should sit on the Golden Stool. And he orders his soldiers to have it found. And the Asante did not like this. They heard that somebody wanted to sit on their stool, and nothing pisses these people off more than someone wanting to sit on their sacred golden stool. Why didn't they make it like a sacred spike, or like, you know, something that nobody would want to sit on in the first place? So the leaders of the Asante Hine, they never even sat on this stool. That's how, there's literally pictures of this stool, and it's funny because you'll see the leader of the Asante sitting in his chair, and then next to him, in its own chair, is the stool itself, just sitting there on its side, like, what's up, I'm a stool. So no one was allowed to sit on this goddamn stool. It was very important to them. So this started a series of skirmishes. The British then retreated to a small stockade, including that dumbass, what was his name, Frederick Mitchell Hodgson. He's in there. He's stuck in the stockade with some colonial officials, and I guess they had like 500 of their Nigerian allies, probably some conscripts, local conscripts, like the British were known to do. So they were then besieged here for months until a rescue party would show up to save them. And this rescue party showed up in June, but being under siege for so long, there were so many that were sick, and they just couldn't escape or be evacuated. So now there's 12,000 Asante warriors involved in this whole thing. This is how pissed off they get about a golden stool. So along the road to Kumasi, this rescue party has several small battles with the Asante. You know, several skirmishes, but, you know, they make it to the fort. And the remaining Asante leadership mounts an attack again, but they're defeated. And this time, the British waved their finger at them and said, all right, now all of your leadership is going to the Seychelles. I mean, I'm not sure why they end up exiled to the Seychelles. I probably should have looked up why specifically they went there, but it's just such a stupid and needless war. 1,000 British soldiers died, and over 2,000 Asante died. So 3,000 casualties, and I'm sure all kinds of other injuries. This conflict actually had more casualties than all the other Anglo-Asante wars combined. It's so silly. Just such a needless war. So then the Asante officially become part of the Gold Coast Colony on January 1st, 1902, only on the condition, only, they will only do this if the Golden Stool would not be violated by the British or any other non-Akan foreigners. So the British agreed, and then they became part of the Gold Coast Colony. But what was the fate of the Golden Stool then? Well, it was actually the Asante hid it, and they hid it really well until some African road workers happened to find it. It was around I think it was 1923. And, you know, they find it, and it's covered in gold, you know, so they're like, whoa, crap, what is this thing? Let's take some gold. So they stripped some of the golden adornments off of it. Remember, it's It's a golden stool, but it's actually wood underneath, and the gold is like pressed on like gold leaf with these inlays and grooves. So they were able to kind of strip this gold off. Well, they were later caught, and the stool was recovered and repaired, and the two men were then tried according to local customs. I am surprised that they didn't murder them on sight, but they were sentenced to death. However, the British intervened, because it is their colony now, and instead they banished these two individuals. Yeah, I don't think they had plans on sticking around anyway. So, but now the Golden Stool is still in the Asante's possession. Sure, they're not like a official, like, you know, they don't have their own borders, you know, they're part of Ghana, but the Asante people are still around and they still have their customs. I think it's cool. They still have the Golden Stool. It's great that they're able to keep that culture alive. So that's the Anglo-Asante Wars. Reflecting on all these conflicts, it's just a reminder to me that most wars are really just fought over resources. I know that might seem obvious to you, but I kind of like to take the approach of, I try to take a certain naive approach to things, so to not make too many assumptions, because then you make too many assumptions and you start reinforcing biases and things like that. I'm trying to stay open-minded. And so let's just look at it that way for a second. Okay, resources. It's over resources. And there's always going to be righteous and high-minded people like those missionaries who they claim they're there for a higher purpose, and I'm sure they are. But, you know, the driving force is really over the resources, like gold, and gold being the most valuable resources. But it's also over land, sure, but that's just what the land gives them, access to more resources. And the British wanted to secure gold access and make their nation rich and as powerful as they could. And same could be said about the Asante. And so why are we fighting over resources? Well, it's to bring security to our people, right? It's about really a different way of looking at it, I guess, would be that it's the wars aren't necessarily at their roots in terms of resources, but rather about security for us and disregarding them. You know, it's, well, that's their problem, right? We're worried about securing resources for us. And it's just like that Pink Floyd song, you know, Us and Them. I love a good saxophone solo, you know. Anyway, as our global economic and communications infrastructure, you know, it keeps growing. And more people from different countries are making friends and bonds across the world more than ever before. You know, this is very unique, the situation we're in. And more businesses in the same way are becoming multinational. And it leads to questions like, who are people going to be loyal to in the future? You know, because you've got, it's about us. Well, who is us in this scenario? So have you ever heard of the Golden Arches theory of conflict prevention? It's sort of relates to this. So there was this theory popularized by Thomas Friedman in the 1990s. He wrote a book called The World is Flat. It wasn't about the world being flat. It was more about economics. But anyway, this theory that he had posits that countries with McDonald's franchises are economically developed enough to avoid war with each other, as they have vested interest in maintaining peace for trade and economic stability. I mean, it kind of makes sense, sure. It was an interesting theory, and it seemed to hold true at the time, but then, you know, there was a war in Kosovo, then a war in Lebanon, and then Russia started a spate of problems that are still going on to this day. Ironically, they don't have a McDonald's anymore, Russia. I mean, I don't know if you've seen, but they have this, like, the McDonald's all got replaced by some, you know, Russian version of McDonald's because, you know, all those companies left, and now Russia's got their own version of things in a way now. But, you know, still, Friedman's theory is pointing in the direction towards less war. You know, it is the way that our society is headed. There's all kinds of other problems we could talk about, but I really hope it does lead to less war in the future. I think there's a lot. We have a very long way to go. There's still every bit of chance for giant global war, obviously. But I don't know. I'm a bit of an optimist. I hope that's the case. So anyway, where does the show go next? Right? Okay. We've clearly had a link to slavery in the Caribbean, which I talked about more in the previous episode, though. So it would be interesting to go there and learn about like plantation life and what it was like on these plantations. But I kind of feel like that's just going to lead us back to the colonies where I had kind of started this run. This kind of started with Benjamin Franklin. Then it went to London. Then it went to the Royal African Company. Then it went to the Asante Empire. So I don't really want to go right back towards the United States right now. At least not yet. I mean, okay, so I could go look at this Mysore Kingdom. That's kind of interesting that they developed these. I want to know more about these rockets, and I definitely do want to get there. But there's just a lot to delve into there, but I don't think we're going to go there yet. I think I'm going to go with Sierra Leone and we'll start by looking at the Black loyalists of Sierra Leone. And then, but I don't want to just go there. I want to start looking farther back in history. And I think we're going to, after this, work our way across the African plain, or African plain, like I know what I'm talking about. I don't even know where that is. I'm assuming it's the part between the desert and the jungle, you know, the buffer zone between the two. We could talk about that, honestly, about how the desert's growing and there's this great effort to prevent the desert from spreading down southward, which is really interesting. But anyway, we will dig deep into Africa's history next episode. We're going farther back. It's going to be less wars. It's going to be more culture, more understanding the overall picture of the Gold Coast of Africa. And it should be fun. I hope you'll join me for that. This is the first episode of 2024 this year. And this year, I really hope to keep building on this show. I spent the last 6 months or so teaching myself about podcasting. You know, I didn't really know a ton about it. I'm not obviously you know exactly what kind of speaker I am if you've been listening for the past 51 minutes, but I am working on all that, trying to make myself more clear and not, you know, I know I tend to have a stilted voice sometimes, and I'm trying to just keep, just did it there. I'm trying to keep it smooth and keep it running. Every once in a while, I have a script in front of me, and here I go. I'm going off script here, but I have a script in front of me, and I could just read from the script and be very like this and say this thing and then that thing, but that kind of talking just kind of puts me to sleep. I want it to feel like somebody's talking to you and that you're more of a participant and not just like, it just don't want it to sound so academic, you know, it's more fun. I think I have more fun learning from somebody who's just talking shit than from some highbrow professor somewhere. But anyway, I know I've got a long way to go in my presentation. I've got some way to go in my writing. I'm working on that. And I really appreciate you sticking around. I thank you so much for listening. This has been Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble, and I'll see you next week.